KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
nerd. Hey, Ray.
Hey, David, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm so excited about today's guest, but I don't want to get to it just yet.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
Any paleo news?
Well, I was in Florida last week.
Oh, that's right.
Just last Saturday, I was digging up gomphotheres and mastodons and rhinos with Kirk Johnson and the crew from the Florida Museum of Natural History.
That's amazing. And what sediment is this? What strata is this? Is this a river deposit? Or
It's a near shore river deposit, kind of an estuary, because mixed in with all that stuff, it's crazy. There's shark teeth, and they found a megalodon tooth in there, too. So.
Right.
You know, imagine a megalodon taking down a gomphotheer.
A gomphotheer.
Yeah. But
yeah, the gomphotheer really cool. Would have to wade out into the ocean in order for the megalodon to grab it.
It can happen.
Well, you know, back in the 20s, the Brisbane River, which is a pretty big river, goes many, many miles inland. A few people got killed, and they thought it could have been a great white, but it was most likely a very large bull shark, which went all the way up into the fresh water. So could have megalodon.
I don't think megalodon could go up a river because they're too, unless it was a very big river, but you
or
know,
a very small megalodon.
It was really cool. I was out there with Kirk. We're doing research for our big fossil atlas that we're working on. And I've found some pretty cool experts that I think we can have on in future shows. I did reporting too as I was down there. So maybe there's something there. I don't know yet, but it was
very
great
cool.
fun.
Great and fun. What was the most amazing find that you did? You find, or were you just watching them dig, or did you actually dig?
Well, they put me down. I had to stay in my grid. That's very hard for me to stay in the grid. And there were about 20 people out there digging that day. It's a site south of Gainesville that the museum has been excavating for about 10 years. They've pulled out 40,000 bones out of there. It's just crazy productive,
right.
And warehouses full of stuff. But they put me on a square, and I, you know, where I was for sure going to find something. And I found all morning, I found like a chunk of turtle. And then in the afternoon, I was renewed and went back and found some ribs, man. Ribs.
Oh, cool. Turtle ribs or?
No. Gomphotheer, you know, four tusked mastodons.
Yeah. And, the shovel tuskers.
Related to the shovel, they got four tusks, two tusks at the bottom, two at the top. But in the meantime, Kirk's digging right next to me, and he's finding all kinds of cool stuff. He found a perfect soft-shell turtle skull.
Wow.
And he found a big vertebrae, and so I had fossil envy right away.
Yeah. So. Fossil envy. And how old is the strata?
It's Miocene. So it's Miocene. It's 5 million-ish. If we do a show on it, I'll dial all the stuff in.
Miocene is 5 million to 23 million years ago.
There you go. I got it. 5 million. Yeah. So I think it's 5.8. And I've got a geologic time scale behind me, too. So
yeah, anyways. You do. And I believe I recognize that artwork, too.
Yeah.
Let's talk about our guest. I'm so excited. So what is great is you said over Christmas, what are you reading, Dave? I said, well, I just finished Moby Dick. You said, well, I'm reading a book on geology.
Yeah.
And so I went and started reading it. I could not put it down.
Yeah, it's one of those books. I read one of these short little New Yorker reviews of this book saying it's a really cool book. It's by a geologist. It's a bit philosophical, but it gives you importance of, you know, knowing our place and what we are on Earth and as Earthlings. And I picked it up, and I couldn't put it down, and we read it simultaneously.
We did.
So,
well, let's talk to our author, and she is Marcia Bjarnerud.
Yeah.
And she wrote the most amazing book that we read called
Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. It's such an awesome book. I was reading it. Suggested
then you turned me on to it, and I couldn't put it down.
And
it's the best thing I've read since John McPhee.
Okay,
let's dig down deep.
Deep, baby. Hey, Dave, meet Marcia Jornarud, a structural geologist, an author of numerous books, and a professor of geosciences at Lawrence University in Wisconsin. Her most recent book is Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. And thank you, Marcia, for being with us today.
Well, as a non-paleontologist, I'm very honored to be joining you.
Well, we interview all types of people, scientists, marine biologists. It's not just dinosaur people. So
artists.
Yeah, many artists. We run the gamut. But so I'm not going to ask if you're a paleo nerd. Are you a geo nerd?
Oh, absolutely. Unabashedly. Deep in my bones.
So, yeah, I've noticed a little bit here on interviews, and actually when we were talking about having you on the show, you didn't want to talk about dinosaurs. You think that's a bit of a distraction, or you got to think
about dinosaurs? Yeah, what is it about dinosaurs that bristles your spine?
I do like dinosaurs. I just think they're the attention-hogging celebrities of the paleontological and geological world, and there are just many other stories to tell. But I love you dinosaur people and respect your deep knowledge. And my main credential in the dinosaur world was I shared a house for 2 years with Dave Festovsky, who's one of a very eminent dinosaur paleontologist, wrote one of the main textbooks on dinosaurs. So yes, it's just not my field.
Yeah. And I would say too that they're basically kind of the gateway drug, or if you will, to science, you know. But I'm not really so much a dinosaur nerd. I am a paleontology nerd. But
wait, I got to say one thing, ladies and gentlemen. That? I started off in geology. My brother was living in the Owens Valley, which you wrote about in your book. Been there many times. And he started me on John McPhee's Basin and Range. So before I ever did and was interested in Wonderful Life by Gould, it was John McPhee. So there you go, Ray.
Yeah. So you came in through a literary door.
Yes, I did. Well, literary and walking around the giant mountain of obsidian.
Okay. Well, my question was, so you grew up in Wisconsin, you went to college, and your conversion to the wonders of geology happened in college. You took a geology class, Rocks for Jocks, you kind of described it as.
Right. I think like many geologists, I had no real exposure to the field until I came into college. And I grew up at a time when there really weren't too many female mentors in science broadly. And as a first-year student in college, didn't really think of myself as a science type at all. And it was only when I signed up for an introductory class, mainly to tick the box on the lab science requirement. And I took geology largely because I'd heard there were great field trips, chance to get out of town, be outside. It was just an epiphany. I saw the huge explanatory power of geology and understood that it was above all a kind of lens for seeing the world in four dimensions.
Right.
And so even, you know, as a first year student in college, there was something that just put my brain on fire about the explanatory nature of the field.
Well, did you have a dynamic professor that you can acknowledge? Or
I did, and I think so many geologists really love what they do. And he was so enthusiastic. His lectures were just overstuffed with facts and slides and samples and maps. And you know, I think that was part of the appeal too. That clearly someone who was close to his retirement at that point was still so excited about what he did.
Yeah. Well, it comes through in all the talks that you've given and some of the lectures Dave and I have watched. Your talks are, I think, transformative as well. I picked up your book because I saw the little New Yorker review saying it was a wonderful book and it mentioned geology. And as Dave said, it's an incredible book. It's part memoir, part philosophy, and a whole lot of rocks.
Yeah, but I think what also it does is it captures what you said is 4D. Explain to our listeners how you see the processes, the geologic processes, in four dimensions. I think I have an idea.
Well, by that, of course, I mean 3D plus time. So I've come to realize I've taught geology to college students now for more than 30 years, and I've realized that that's the real cognitive challenge in the geosciences. It's not just mastering the vocabulary and learning rocks and mineral names, but really having this visualization capacity to see landscapes as evolving entities over time. So especially in my field of structural geology, which has to do with the architecture of the crust, how mountains grow and change over time. We have to be able to read maps in 2D and from those make inferences into the subsurface in cross-sectional view, but then also understand that these mountains came together through folding and faulting over time. So developing that sort of cinematic understanding of landscapes and the architecture of the crust, it's very challenging, and it, yeah. it takes development.
I remember John McPhee saying that if you could look at, let's say, North America in geologic time, Yucatans and Floridas would be underwater one moment and then above the next. Mountains would melt like sherbet. Lakes and rivers would dry up like pools after a rainstorm. So that was a fantastic way that made me see the immensity of time as almost in an animation in my head.
Yeah.
What I loved about the way you teach, too, is that you're quoted as saying geology really takes a lot of imagination and creativity to envision these kind of things.
Definitely. And I think that's underappreciated and maybe because it's not an attribute that we associate with science, we almost right. are apologetic about it. I think it's a very sophisticated set of cognitive practices. And articulating why that's difficult can be useful to students too, that if they're struggling with this. Well, yeah, it's because it's not easy to do. I'm actually teaching a seminar on Mars, not on Mars, about Mars, this term. And it's
I hope it's how we shouldn't go there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, looking at the huge amounts of new data we have, both from orbiters and landers, the rovers, over the last 15 years or so, and it really occurred to me the other day when we were talking about the geography of Mars. Technically, we should say areography. But anyway, that all of those things, the giant volcanoes, Olympus Mons and the other Tharsis volcanoes and this huge scar that's called Valles Marineris, very deep canyon, order of magnitude deeper and longer than the Grand Canyon, they've never moved anywhere. They formed right where they are, and they're still there billions of years later. And at the same time, I'm teaching our historical geology course, History of Earth and Life, and you know, I'm constantly flashing at the students paleogeographic maps showing where the continents are at different times and mountain ranges coming and going like you were describing. And you know, that contrast just struck me, that everything on Mars is just, you know, forms and it never moved again, whereas on Earth everything is moving around.
Is that because Mars is basically cold and the mantle has cooled down and there isn't the internal convection like on planet Earth?
Exactly. So that there's been some kind of sluggish single plate tectonics there, perhaps billions of years ago, that did cause the rift and some volcanism, but no plate tectonics as we know it, no motion of the parts of the crust relative to each other.
Well, that's what I got from your book too, is that Earth is so dynamic, so almost literally alive. You can think of it just, it's always in transition. But that all the other planets in the solar system are so boring in comparison.
Yes, why does Earth have such a variety of minerals and elements compared to the other cold, dark bodies in our solar system?
It's because so many things are happening here. Minerals don't just exist. They come into being because of processes and the opportunities for different elements to meet each other and bond and form minerals. So I think the emphasis in too many of our geoscience classes on rocks and minerals just as objects to be identified and not as records of process is the wrong sort of emphasis to make. You probably know of Robert Hazen at the Carnegie Institute. He's a very eminent mineralogist, and he's really revolutionized the way people are talking about minerals these days by speaking of mineral evolution.
Right. For example, the Great Oxygenation Event created oxygen, but that also opened the door for other minerals to form.
Precisely.
Can you explain how that kind of came to be?
The Great Oxygenation Event, what happened?
Well, no, that was caused through archaic life creating oxygen.
Right.
But the fact that oxygen then, they terraformed our planet to have an oxygen-rich atmosphere, but that gave birth to new minerals. Why?
Right, because suddenly all these oxidation reactions that couldn't happen in a reducing atmosphere became possible. So mineral oxides, sulfates, phosphates, suddenly could form in different settings, both in marine and terrestrial environments. So, yeah, just a whole family of new mineral types that involve the reaction of free oxygen with unoxidized minerals could happen, and then also gave rise to new organisms, which then also exude different substances and also make possible new opportunities for compounds to come together. So yeah, the diversity of minerals on Earth is just so far outstrips what we know of other planets. Admittedly, we have investigated Earth more thoroughly, but it's like an order of magnitude more than on the Moon or Mars, you know, even in the, if we are generous with the way we count these minerals on other bodies.
Do you think the presence of life on this planet?
Right, that's where I was going.
Is that why we have such a diverse array of minerals and
substances? It's partly that. Partly that, definitely. And I think in Hazen's very exhaustive inventory, his group is arguing that something on the order of 35 to 40% of the minerals on Earth are directly or somewhat indirectly biogenic. And that would include, because the oxygen in the atmosphere is a biological product, it would include, you know, oxides and things. But then water, too, is the great... Water facilitates biological reactions, but also all kinds of other reactions. So the combination of having biological processes, water, and plate tectonics that can take rocks from one environment to another, where they can be metamorphosed and transformed, is yet a third reason for the huge diversity of minerals we have.
Wow.
So all of this is pretty mind-blowing here, just everything you said in the last few minutes. Biogenic rocks. So that really means that life affected the very structure of the planet, right? And rocks all have a story that's are tied to life here on the planet.
Well, 40%.
Right. The most important example would be carbonate rocks like limestone, which are largely biogenic.
Right.
And they are Earth's long-term carbon sequestration strategy. Volcanoes exhale carbon dioxide and other gases. And if we didn't have this way of putting away that CO2 that goes into the atmosphere over the long haul, Earth would be a runaway greenhouse planet like Venus.
Right.
But organisms have learned to take that carbon dioxide, combine it with calcium, especially in seawater, and sequester it in mineral form as calcite, the main ingredient in limestone.
So I'm talking to you from Kansas. And going out to western Kansas and the chalk rock quite a bit and the limestone formations out there, I always like to point at the chalk, these layers and layers of chalk, and say, you know, that's plankton, you know, just piled up.
Plankton, are those coccolithophores? What kind of plankton are they?
Probably coccolithophores and foraminifera, both
right,
calcifying.
Foraminifera.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of our favorite words here, coccolithophores, so fun to say.
Yeah.
And they're so beautiful, too.
Yes.
Yeah. And here's a little etymological note, Cretaceous, that's the age of your beautiful chalks out there in Kansas. That comes from the word for chalk in Latin. So that whole period in the Mesozoic is named for chalk, fine-grained limestone.
Right. Well, you said that one of the things you love about geology is the nomenclature and the naming and the etymology of how rocks are described and named.
I do love that. And yeah, again, I came into college as a more of a humanities person, and I always loved word origins, etymologies.
I love it, too.
And, yeah, and so at first, I mean, I love the kind of idiosyncratic vocabulary of geology. I know some people find it off-putting. It's not systematic. It's inherited from many different traditions, you know, ranging from classical times. Some are neologisms that have been made up. But I kind of love that. Just hodgepodge nature of the vocabulary.
And how the words are all related, you know.
Pseudo-tachylites? How do you say that?
Pseudo-tachylite. Terrible word for a wonderful rock.
Yeah, pseudo-tachylite. We'll get into that in a second.
I wanted to ask one question while I have. I used to live in Wisconsin. I'm in Kansas now. I mostly live in Alaska, a great subduction zone. But I lived in La Crosse for my senior year in high school. We moved around a lot. And I remember the wonderful cliffs along the Mississippi River and the big rocky formations there. What are they?
Those are mostly limestones and dolostones, Ordovician age mainly.
All right.
the topography of that area of Wisconsin is distinctive. As you probably know, we call it the Driftless Area, which is a wonderful anachronism I can explain. Most of Wisconsin was covered with glaciers during the Ice Age, the Pleistocene. But each time there was an ice advance, and there were probably several, that area, for somewhat poorly understood reasons, was not glaciated. So it preserves an older landscape that is basically shaped by the Mississippi and its precursor river systems.
You mean it was ice-free?
Yeah. Oh. So very strange, because there are glacial deposits that go down as far as southern Ohio.
Yeah.
So it's not like, it wasn't far enough north or something. And the thinking these days, I think, is that each time tongues of ice came down from Hudson Bay area, they encountered a kind of paleo version of Lake Superior and would be stalled by calving off into a body of water. And then the climate warmed up again and the ice retreated, and it just multiple times never became glaciated. So that's a very distinctive landscape in southwestern Wisconsin, southeastern Minnesota, northeastern Iowa, and a little bit of northwestern Illinois that's very rugged, and it's incised deeply by Mississippi River streams.
Right. I have a question about how you know what strata is below your feet. There's a fantastic website called Macrostrat, and you can see the entire planet and what age of what rock is at the surface. Does that mean that every square inch of this planet, a geologist wandered and took a measurement or did a drill or a coring? How do we have such an accurate map of every square meter of this planet?
We don't really. A lot of it is inference. There are huge areas in Kansas, for example, where you're not going to see bedrock exposed to the surface. But we can kind of connect the dots and interpolate. And certainly there are places like in Antarctica where we have only a few Nunataks sticking out of the ice and a few ice-covered areas near the shore and very little direct observation, maybe some geophysical. So the coverage is heterogeneous, I would say. Some places we know really, really well, others not so well. But there's some information, I think, at this point about most places, but the resolution differs quite a bit.
By the way, a Nunatak is a rock ridge or mountain peak that sticks out of an ice field or glacier. Islands in the snow, basically.
Right, but that means geologists walked the planet. Did they do it on a grid? Obviously in the middle of a farmland, you can infer what's underneath there, but someone had to place that on a map, and it had to be approved by the Geological Society of America or whoever the governing body is, correct?
So this raises a really good point that it's taken two centuries of people mapping rocks for different reasons to create anything like a global coverage that we have today, which still really isn't complete. The degree of detail differs from place to place. So some people have been very motivated by economic reasons, of course. Some places are very well mapped because they have petroleum deposits or mineral deposits. And then I actually, in my own PhD work, mapped a part of the world that up to that point in the early 1980s had not been mapped in Svalbard up in the Norwegian Arctic. So it was a very old-fashioned sort of thesis project to just fill a blank map, describe the rocks, describe the stratigraphy, and create a map of a huge area that was pretty remote and hadn't been described. And so it's not a systematic thing. People over time have contributed to this vast project of mapping the rocks around the world.
Well, I would say I mainly live in Ketchikan, Alaska, and slowly became geologically aware of what was going on there. My mind was began to hang out with geologists, Forest Service geologists, and I know the mapping is still continuing there in southeast, because what they thought was maybe Ordovician is now Carboniferous, but it's people really hiking up into remote areas and identifying the rocks and using fossils, to figure it out. But yeah, when I became aware of the geology of Southeast Alaska and realizing I was in a subduction zone and all these outer islands, I live in the very southern tip of Southeast Alaska, all these outer islands are basically moving toward to the continent of North America and subducting under, and that, this geologic age was on this island, there's another one on that island. It's such a dynamic area. And have you ever been there, Marcia, the Southeast?
Yeah, I have. And it's the geology is really complicated. And as you said, still being worked out. And a couple of thoughts occurred to me as you were describing it. First, there's a kind of a bad pun.
I know.
I've
drawn it. I've actually drawn it. The terrain wreck.
Terrain wreck. Yeah. The terrain in the geological sense, T-E-R-R-A-N-E. Yeah. Meaning a chunk of crust that has a different origin to the continent that it happens to be attached to now. And Alaska is kind of the classical example of that. But then I also wanted to say that the ability to make sense of such a complicated tectonic mosaic has only really been available because of the analytical methods we have these days that would range from very high precision dating methods to geochemical methods that allow us to say something about the tectonic setting in which different igneous rocks might have formed. And so we're really in a golden age in the geosciences. And that's kind of a thread that I try to weave throughout the book too, that my own career has happened to coincide with this just flowering of both analytical methods and conceptual frameworks that give us this very new and bracing top-down view of the planet over time.
You know, I wanted to say with that bad pun, Southeast Alaska terrain wreck, I've actually drawn the terrains as a train, you know, actually piling up in North America. I did them all in order, and I worked with geologists to actually, and we have this in an exhibit of mine that traveled around. But can you explain what subduction is to the non-geologically inclined?
But also include why water by the hydrology is the important part of subduction.
Okay. First of all, I would like, if you would share that graphic, I would love to use
it'll
it.
It'll be on your
teaching.
Page.
Okay.
On your page at paleonerds.com, there'll be a beautiful Rachel
okay,
painting.
Great train wreck. Okay.
Marcia, I do a lot of charts, and I will plug your inbox with them, and you can use them in your classes, please.
Thank you. So subduction
ahead.
Subduction is the signature process of Earth's plate tectonic system. It's the way that the oceanic crust is recycled on 100 million year timescales. So Earth alone, we think, has two distinct types of crust, granitic continental crust and basaltic oceanic crust.
Ah.
Both came out of the mantle originally through melting or partial melting of the mantle. And over time, Earth alone has distilled this stuff we call granite out of a mantle that is really not granite. That, once it's formed, is pretty robust. And the oldest rocks we have on Earth are granitic continental crust as old as 4 billion years. In contrast, the basaltic ocean crust is recycled, as I said, on a timescale of like 150 to 200 million years. There is no ocean crust older than, I think, Middle Jurassic Age, and that's up in near Alaska, up in the northwestern Pacific Ocean.
It's like a conveyor belt that just keeps...
Right. So ocean crust is born at the mid-ocean ridges, like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, mostly underwater, but Iceland is one place where that stands above water.
So wait, so you have a suture that is constantly vomiting magma.
Not a nice metaphor, but okay.
But in two directions, so it's spreading, correct?
Spreading out, right. So batches of magma are rising and melting because of decompression. That's an important idea that when rock is close to its melting point, but then still solid, if you decompress it, it will melt. So the melting temperature...
Lower pressure equals... Wait a minute. Higher pressure equals higher temperature. I'm confused.
Well, we're used to water, which is a completely abnormal substance that actually melts when it's under higher pressure. But normal substances, their melting temperature increases with pressure.
Right.
So if you decompress them, they actually will melt, even if they're cooling off. It's a little counterintuitive.
Right.
But that's what's happening at the mid-ocean ridges. So batches of magma come up at not single conical volcanoes, but fissures on the seafloor. And then as new batches emerge at the same site, the old ones are pushed aside. And over time, the ocean floor grows. And that seafloor is cooling and becoming denser. And ultimately, when it's about 150 or 170 million years old, it becomes dense enough to start sinking back into the mantle. So that's what subduction is. But here's some things that are really amazing to me about this process. So basalt is born from the mantle by partial melting of the mantle, and then it cools and it becomes dense enough to start to sink. But it wouldn't really be efficiently recycled back into the mantle if it didn't change to a much denser metamorphic form called eclogite, which is a weird metamorphic rock because we don't see it at the surface much. It's formed at depths of 40 or 50 kilometers, so kind of hard to get back to the surface, but once in a while it does make it back. But that's a very dense rock because the feldspars, which are a major constituent of basalt, are transformed at those great depths to garnet, which is a very, very dense mineral. And that makes that old basaltic ocean crust actually a little bit denser than the ambient mantle and pulls the slab deeper down into the mantle, making a very efficient deep recycling of material that was at the surface of the Earth into the interior of the Earth again.
Because of its weight, because it's so dense, it weighs more, and that's why it sinks back into...
Right. If it didn't transform to that, then it wouldn't. If it was just basalt, then it's not denser than the ambient mantle, which is made mainly of the mineral olivine. But garnet, which is denser than olivine, and sinks back in the mantle. And then the water connection is this, that we think that metamorphism really can't happen without the assistance of water.
Yeah.
The metamorphism involves reorganization of crystals, solid state recrystallization without melting. And if you think about it, that really is hard. That means atoms have to be moving around in solids. And if diffusion alone were the only thing that was going on, that would really be so slow that even over geologic timescales, it probably would not happen. But water allows elements to get into solution and move from one place to the other.
At great densities, correct?
At depth. Probably water in a supercritical form.
But metamorphic rock is rock that's changed under pressure?
Yep, or other environmental conditions, right?
Right.
So with water, I often say it's kind of like the difference between trying to drive in gridlock in Manhattan versus taking the subway.
Right.
So diffusion is driving in gridlock. Advective ion transport, which means elements moving with water, is like taking the subway. And so it's much more efficient. You can reorganize crystals in the presence of water orders of magnitude faster than you could with just diffusion alone.
Wow.
So we need water for that metamorphic transformation. And then other water connection is that the subducting slab takes a lot of water back into the mantle with it. When basalt is born at mid-ocean ridges, right away, huge amounts of seawater flush through the ridges, and they create the black smokers that I'm sure people have seen with the tube worms and all the crazy non-photosynthesizing organisms. And so there's water bound physically and chemically in the ocean crust from the moment it's formed, and that water goes back down into the mantle with the subducting ocean crust and recharges the mantle with water. And the mechanical effect of that is to lower the effective viscosity of the mantle, which is slowly convecting as a solid, but it would not probably convect anymore at this late stage in Earth's history because the planet is cooling slowly. But water reduces the strength or viscosity of the mantle and allows convection to continue.
Right. So it is the presence of water that's keeping our planet heated.
Not heated, but convecting.
Convection is movement of heat.
Right. But if the mantle's too stiff, it can't carry that heat.
It can't
to the surface.
Right.
So it's an amazing system. We need the water. And there's probably about an ocean's worth of water or more in the mantle. And it's kind of this planetary savings bank.
You know, I read a book called Water once, and I used to tell my friends, where is the world's greatest amount of water stored? And they'd say, oh, the oceans. Nope. The Arctic. No. It's in a layer 150 kilometers that surrounds the entire planet, and it's made up of, is it olivine or serpentine?
The mantle is, to a first order, mostly olivine, which isn't olivine. Even a mineral that is supposed to have water in it, but there's water and really everything else to make all the rocks in the crust in the mantle.
It's a fourth state of water. You can't squeeze it out.
Yeah, it would be some kind of supercritical.
Yeah.
It would be OH.
Well, when you say there's an ocean of water basically in the mantle, is it physically
it's
within the rock itself, right? It's permeating.
Ever seen an olivine countertop, Ray, in someone's kitchen? It is so heavy because it contains that fourth state of water. Is that correct?
Well, it's chemically bound in the lattice,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, as OH. So it is. We shouldn't be thinking of a big sloshing, you know,
that's what I'm picturing.
Of water in the mantle.
But I want to go swimming there, but it's in the rocks. Okay.
What the water really does is it kind of weakens the bonds between especially silica and oxygen, which are the main constituents of silicate rocks and minerals, and makes them a little weaker.
Wow.
So that's the physical basis of what I was talking about, that water is keeping the convective cycle going.
Wow.
Within that subduction zone, these rocks are now diving back down into the mantle. They've been carried across the ocean. There's all this tension that happens along the continental plates, the edge. That's where a structural geologist
uses your imagination.
Uses their imagination, but that's where the work is really done in terms of earthquakes. And then that pressure at the edges of the continent causes mountain building. I mean, this is geology 101.
Well, I have a question right about this subduction zone here in California. Throughout my travels in the Mojave, Joshua Tree and the Alabama Hills and the Owens Valley, these are giant quartz monzonite boulders that weather into the most beautiful shapes. Joshua Tree is the most famous of that. And those are granite plutons that, because they weigh less than the surrounding strata, rise up and are exposed? Or do I have that backwards or completely wrong?
That's right. So today in California, other than north of Mendocino, there's not any subduction going on. But there was in Jurassic time, during dinosaur time, a plate that was sort of the precursor to it's the Juan de Fuca plate, was being subducted beneath California and creating what we would call an arc complex. So there's a second reason that melting can occur that's totally different than that decompression melting I mentioned. And this is, so if you think about it, it's kind of weird in a subduction setting like Japan or Indonesia or the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. Why do we get melting? A cold slab is going down into the mantle. Why are there volcanoes above that cold slab? The answer is not adding heat. It is water, again, being released by the downgoing slab at about the depth that eclogite is forming. And that water acts to lower the melting temperature of the mantle above the downgoing slab.
Oh.
So it acts as what we call a flux, meaning it's like in steelmaking, you add small amounts of sodium and other things calcium to lower the melting temperature. And that's what water does to rocks. So And it's kind of the same mechanism I was talking about. It gets into the bonds between silicon and oxygen, and that weakens them and makes it easier for the rocks to melt. And that's the origin, then, of these island arcs like Japan or Indonesia,
right,
or continental arcs like the Sierra Nevada and the Granodiorites and Joshua Tree, where they were actually probably, it was a mantle melt thanks to water reducing the melting temperature, and that mantle melt underplated the ancient North American continent and remelted rocks above and gave rise to these granites.
You know, you talk like an engineer. It's absolutely amazing.
Have you done work in structural geology, mountain building, earthquakes? I know in your book, and what's brilliant in your book is you tell personal stories, your life events, and then you just seamlessly move from your personal life to rocks. You experienced an earthquake in Italy that sounded pretty intense. Do you actually work in the field of earthquake prediction? Or I know that's of great concern.
Ray, I thought you read her book.
Well, I did. I did read it.
We can't predict earthquakes. I just want to say that clearly.
Okay.
Because, but we know where they're likely to happen. And in a very, you know, probabilistic sense, we can give, you know, risk assessments. So yes, I do study ancient earthquakes, and including this strange rock we mentioned briefly, pseudotachylite. A terrible name, really. It's so nobody even, many geologists don't even
it's
know what
romantic.
Tachylite is.
No, it's a romantic name.
It's fun to say pseudotachylite.
So the pseudo part is false, of course, and tachylite is a type of obsidian, a very black basaltic obsidian. But most, you know, a lot of geologists would never even have heard of pseudotachylite. So pseudotachylite is the one unambiguous indicator of an ancient earthquake, and it's formed by frictional melting on a fault zone. So it's often, it's this glassy looking, very black rock that is typically found in rocks that were deep underground. And so many faults can slip without generating earthquakes, and there are many fault rocks that could have been generated seismically or could have been generated by what we call creep, which is what, like, the middle part of the San Andreas Fault, thankfully, is just creeping along slowly, not generating too many earthquakes. So pseudotachylite is really attractive to us structural geologists because we know that had to be generated in an earthquake because otherwise you wouldn't have generated enough frictional heat to melt the rocks.
And you're talking about massive amount of rock slipping a great distance or in 50 feet or
potentially. I mean, I think probably the smallest magnitude earthquake that could generate any recognizable pseudotachylite would be about a magnitude 6 earthquake.
Right.
So you need pretty significant deep rocks experiencing high stress and then slip on the order of like meters per second and maybe total slip of meters to tens of meters to generate this rock.
How do you identify and infer that 6.0 from, let's say, the chunk you found near Dunedin in the South Island of New Zealand? How do you infer, make that connection between the magnitude, the amount of slippage by the piece of pseudotachylite that you're looking at?
Yeah, that's a great question. It has to do with the idea that really an earthquake, we can calculate the work that the earthquake does on the fault zone. So it's related to the friction on the fault zone and the area of slip and the distance of slip. So it's literally like force times distance. That's the work.
Okay.
And so then we can make inferences about what the melting temperature of the rock was, how much melt we see. It's often, you know, back of the envelope. But there are ways of inferring how much energy the earthquake generated.
Right. Okay, now that answers it.
The rock is the record of the ancient earthquake itself.
Right,
The pseudotachylite.
Can I talk about creep real quick? And then, Ray, I know you have something you want to talk about.
There's a related rock, the serpentinite, which is fun to say. Is that also earthquake related?
It might be, but not necessarily. So serpentinite, we say.
Serpentinite, excuse me.
Serpentinite.
Serpentinite, I'm calling you.
Yes, serpentinite, I like that. Serpentinite is made by hydration, so water insinuating itself into olivine-rich rocks.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and it's weird because it can flow in the solid state at relatively low temperatures.
Cool.
Like a snake, I suppose.
Yeah, I know, serpentine.
Okay, you mentioned the creep of the San Andreas Fault. I live in Ojai, and the mountains behind my house have cold water formation, which is marine sediments that were formed 30 to 40 million years ago down by Tijuana, so 190 miles south. So they say, I don't know who's they, but the Pacific plate creeps 5 centimeters northward average. And obviously, you can't put your finger on that. It's give or take maybe 10 million years, nothing happens. But my question is, for these rocks to have moved 190 miles in, let's say, 30 million years, would that have required a million 10.0 earthquakes? And when you say creep, if you were standing here, would you have felt this movement? Or is it a million 10.0 earthquakes?
No 10.0 earthquakes on Earth, thank God.
Okay.
The biggest, the biggest ever, I think, 9.2.
In Alaska.
10 would be truly terrifying, yeah. Unless we're counting maybe seismicity related to meteorite impact.
Was that the Good Friday quake?
The Good Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's one off the coast of Chile in 1960 that was close to that. So no magnitude 10.
Okay.
But lots and lots of perhaps 6, 7, and 8s over time. Yeah. But also sometimes just interspersed with non-seismic creep. It just depends on, you know, the frictional characteristics of a given segment of the fault.
Yeah, I just look out my window and I see the strata 2,000 feet in these mountains, knowing it was a beautiful estuary 190 miles south. It's just so hard to fathom the movement from there to here. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned meteor impacts or asteroid impacts. And in the course of our lifetimes, too, there's been these big paradigm shifts and these big realizations, not only with, you know, continental drift and plate tectonics, but, you know, in the 1980s with the Chicxulub, the asteroid that ended the reign of the dinosaurs, now pretty commonly accepted that that's what did it, along with maybe Gerda Keller's assertion that it had something to do with the Deccan Traps.
In India.
And so that idea, and I love how you describe this in the book, is that the ejecta, the stuff that was thrown out from the crater, was found, that was the first thing, the iridium layer around the planet. And so they were actually tracking the ejecta to find the crater itself. But then there's an interesting story about the Sudbury crater in Thunder Bay that I thought maybe you might want to share, and these biology teachers.
Yeah. So, yes, the whole Chicxulub crater story, I've had sort of close-up view because the place in Italy where I was teaching was actually Walter Alvarez's own base camp in the Italian Apennines where they first discovered the iridium layer.
Right.
And in the book, I kind of contrast some of the really vehement and quite nasty
right
debate around whether it was only an asteroid impact or whether the Deccan Traps were also involved. And I think it's become so bitter that we kind of have to wait until the main actors are off stage.
Well, you geologists become really convective.
So I kind of contrast that story with the amazing discovery of the second largest known, or the ejecta layer from the second largest known impact, which is the impact happened at Sudbury, Ontario, which is just north of Lake Huron. And it's been known probably since the 1960s as a crater. It's also a huge nickel mining area. There's a nickel deposit that was formed from the melt sheet from that impact. And it's bigger than...
It's visible from space, right? It's
yeah,
massive.
It is. Yeah. Partly because of the impact and partly because of the horrible acid rain in that area from smelting nickel sulfides for a century. And it's bigger than the Chicxulub crater. But it happened 1.85 billion years ago when the biosphere was microbial. It must have been a big environmental disruption, but we can't really tell if there was a mass extinction event or not. Anyway, so we've known about that crater probably since the 60s, but nobody had thought to look for the ejecta layer until two high school teachers in Thunder Bay, Ontario, on the far west side of Lake Superior, which is like 500 miles from Sudbury, realized that the rocks in their own backyard were the same age as the known age of the impact crater. And they got people at the local university to start looking at zircon ages in the banded iron formations in the area that record the great oxygenation event, actually.
And zircon is a great determinant of time.
Right. It's uranium-bearing mineral that can be dated with uranium-lead dating to very high precision for very old rocks. And so they narrowed down where in that section of the banded iron formation sequence they should be looking. And then they started discovering crazy-looking rocks that recorded what must have been giant tsunamis that just ripped up pre-existing iron formations, tumbled them around, and giant pellets of rock that were interpreted as sort of hailstones, that material that would have been falling through an atmosphere that was just choked with pulverized rock, so kind of concentric pellets of rock.
So you're talking bombs and bombs.
And 500 miles away from the impact site. And then the one that really blows my mind are blobs of blackish material that look very much like vesicular basalt. So like, you know, the crusty tops of lava flows in Hawaii.
Right.
But these are interpreted as vaporized rock, rock in the gaseous state that boiled as it cooled and fell back to Earth.
Wow.
So extreme geology.
So it was a gas as it traveled through the atmosphere and then coalesced like a solar system would over billions of years into rocky bits.
Yeah, and then fell down as this horrible hot rain, essentially.
Wow.
Can you actually see the Sudbury crater itself? Is it visible?
Yeah, it's visible from space.
It's
got a bunch
space.
Horizontal kind of islands in it, but it's very noticeable.
Oh, and one thing about it is that it's not a circle anymore because there was a mountain building event that squished it into kind of an elliptical shape. But we can imagine what its original diameter would have been, and it's like 250 kilometers, which is bigger than Chicxulub. globe, which is about 200 kilometers. So this was a major event.
It was the iridium layer, which was the material actually from the asteroid itself, right? So I'm just wondering, with the Sudbury crater, is any of that ejecta the actual asteroid material, do you think, or?
That's hard to say. Yeah, there isn't a strong heavy metal or iridium anomaly associated with it, but there are these very distinctive rock types. So it might have been a different type of meteorite.
Wow.
Yeah, and these rocks are super old. With the Sudbury thing, that blows my mind. It was one day, 1.85 billion years ago, and now it's been found all around the north and southern, the Minnesota, Wisconsin, and UP shores.
So you found it there in Wisconsin? Students go out hunting for it? Or?
We have been hunting for it. It's only in the subsurface in Wisconsin. And as I mentioned in the book, I actually have not been able to see that layer because I testified against a mine that was going to be in the Banded Iron Formation in northern Wisconsin, close to one of the Indian reservations. And
all right.
Then good the company actually happened to intersect the Sudbury ejecta layer there, but I was sort of a persona non grata having testified against them in the state legislature. So
good.
I've seen pictures of it. I've seen pictures of it. And I've found pieces up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan with students and up in northern Minnesota.
Marcia, in watching your talk in the video of the Long Now Foundation, you spoke on so many different levels. It was absolutely inspiring. But one thing that I've always felt, and I'd love you to expand upon this, I've always felt that the Earth is alive. And I don't know if it's you could really say it has a consciousness, but it certainly has a life cycle. And it's not just the rocks recycling themselves, but it's the atmosphere, it's life on Earth, it's the evolution from 4.8 billion years ago to the present, and another 4.8 billion years till the sun does its thing. So just
and wipes us out.
Yeah, and wipes everything out, yeah.
Game over.
I'd love you just to expand on that. And I don't believe it's woo-woo science. I believe it's something that it's not fringe to me. I believe that And most indigenous cultures do view inanimate objects like rocks as alive. And just if you could expand upon that and what you found as a structural geologist, what insights can you tell us about the Earth being a living system?
Yeah, and I do want to emphasize, I hold myself to very high standard of scientific rigor in my work
as
and in my
do.
Writing. Yeah, and so, you know, to some people, maybe this is dangerous territory, but not to acknowledge that Earth is unusual in our planetary family. All of these processes are going on, that the solid Earth itself is a kind of self-renewing, cyborgic entity.
Yeah.
It's certainly animate in the sense of things moving around. It's, you know, sentient in the sense that, I mean, assuming the Earth is not sentient has gotten us into all kinds of trouble, like assuming that anything we do, the Earth won't notice and it'll be fine. It responds to our activities. We can even induce earthquakes by pumping fluids at high pressure.
Sure, fracking induces earthquakes.
Exactly.
Yes.
You know, so Earth responds. It's responsive. Maybe that doesn't mean sentient, but it's kind of, in some sense, sensing things and responding. Landslides can happen in response to climate change that we're causing. Rivers respond to things we do.
We have that, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, is it living? I've always felt a little frustrated with my biological colleagues who say, that is not life. This is the way we define life, and Earth is not alive. It can't reproduce itself, you know. So, okay, but is it dead? Is it not living? You know, so it's something, and I think our obstinate refusal to call it something like living is the problem, because it tends to blind us to this strange quasi-living rock we're living on.
Right, right.
I think it's a two-way street. Life is affected by geology all the time, and geology is affected by life. It's intertwined. And the whole concept, I remember in the book where you just raised the idea of, you've been talking about the idea of Gaia, that the Earth is alive. And
well, that's kind of a New Age thing. But I think her explanation is really from a more of a scientific point of view.
Well, I'm just saying in the book, you even raised this question. I remember in the book, and then you, the geologist you were with just refused to even consider anything about that. Is that too woo-woo for...
Yeah, I mean, I think Gaia has been co-opted a little bit by New Aginess, but there are also legitimate scientific counterpoints to the original kind of orthodox Gaia. So the Gaia hypothesis was that Earth is like a superorganism that can regulate its internal chemistry, and that's not entirely true. I mean, just today in my historical geology class, we were talking about the Permian extinction event, which is a time when the Earth's biogeochemical cycles really went, something went badly wrong.
The Great Dying.
And it wasn't homeostatic. It wasn't controlling. You know, ocean chemistry, you know, became acidified and anoxic. And so, you know, that's not literally true. On the other hand, life has persisted on Earth in an unbroken chain for 3.8 billion years. And so at some level, and many of these are these negative feedbacks that the biosphere itself is maintaining, like sequestering carbon in limestone that's precipitated by biological organisms. So I'm really fascinated with the history of science and the evolution of thinking about these things. And in the book, as you describe, as a young new faculty member, I was involved with writing a new lab manual that was to go along with one of the major textbooks at the time, and the person who had written the textbook was a very eminent faculty member at Yale. And when I thought we were sort of on the same page with the design of our two books, his text and my lab book, and that we were really kind of blowing open the way we were teaching intro classes and trying to make it about process rather than things, so Earth systems focused. Now that's kind of mainstream, but at the time it was not the way intro geo classes were taught. So I thought he'd be open to this sort of at least talking about the Gaia hypothesis and the idea of biogeochemical cycling. And he was just, it was so obvious that he thought it was completely not scientific. I really was shocked. And in subsequent years, it's been really interesting to me to see that old view slowly changing. People don't use the word Gaia in general in geology, but biogeochemistry is now a whole, you know, there are graduate programs in this field. It's a legitimate subdiscipline within the geosciences, and I think that's what Gaia has sort of evolved into.
Right.
There you go.
So, that's a fascinating case of paradigm shift right before our eyes, really happening in the last few decades.
And one thing that I was blown away to learn in your book, that limestone is the deposition of phytoplankton and coccolithophores and all the little tiny organisms that live in the upper part of the ocean and die off and form great layers of thousands of meters thick. But dolomite is the same thing, but changed by bacteria into another mineral altogether. Did I get that right?
That's true. It's still a carbonate mineral, and the big difference between calcite, which is the main mineral in limestone, and dolomite, which is the mineral in dolostone, is magnesium. So one is CaCO3, and the other is CaMgCO3 2.
Let me get my slide rule.
So I mean, one of the amazing things to me, and I'm not a dolomite person, but dolomite
You diss dolomite.
I diss dolomite. I respect dolomite immensely because
it doesn't sound like it, Marcia. I don't know.
Well, I feel a little bad about it, but it is the main carbon sequestration. It's the thing that stores most carbon on Earth. But we don't actually understand how it forms from limestone. There is no place we can look to on Earth today, maybe with a few really minor weird exceptions, that dolostone
is formed by example in extant times, correct?
Right, exactly. So something happens to limestone, probably soon after deposition, that introduces magnesium into it. And for years and years, people tried to understand this, trying to grow dolomite in the lab. The kinetics were so slow. It was like, why does this even happen? And yet we've got these huge banks of dolomite. And now the thinking is there's some kind of microbial reaction that's probably going on in the presence of sulfur that acts as a catalyst for this. But it's still not really very well understood.
So it's possible the introduction of life and organisms is what changes this limestone into dolomite.
Yeah, so again, a biogenic process that is hugely important. Yep.
And are there dolomite caves, or you only find limestone caves?
There are dolomite caves. Dolomite is less soluble, but we're actually quite close to the Niagara Escarpment here, where I am. And up on the escarpment, there are some caves that have developed in some fracture systems. They're just like really long, linear, narrow little things. But yeah, so dolostone is not as soluble as
there isn't the precipitate like you'd find in a limestone cave.
Not much.
Mm-mm. Right.
Is it full of fossils?
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Some are. I mean, we've got some pretty impressive Silurian reefs around here.
Okay.
And most of them were sort of, they call them pinnacle reefs. So they were kind of isolated. And then between the reefs, there wasn't much biological activity. But in some of the caves, you happen to see often like talus falling off the edges.